him with his ditty bag, then turned, cursed fluently, and kicked his bag across the deck and back down the hatch to the crew quarters. Cypress went and took his arm. They went to stand with Ant.
"Go with Amber and Spark," I ordered Lant.
I wasn't invited.
Amber is blind, and Spark is, as others besides you may note, a very pretty girl. Divitan was a pirate town, and I am sure that men with the hearts of pirates still abide here. I know that Althea and Brashen would not deliberately lead them into danger, but if there is danger, I would wish that they had a man who was dedicated solely to protecting them.
Why don't you go yourself?
Because I am sending you,
I replied tersely. Sparks of anger leapt into his eyes, and I modified my tart reply with, I wish to remain on the ship and watch what transpires here. I also wish to charge you with an additional errand. Find someone who has messenger birds,
a wealthy merchant preferably.
Someone who would have connections so that a message capsule might be transferred from bird to bird until it reaches Buckkeep. I'd like to send back word that we are alive and well and continuing our journey.
He was silent for a moment. Then he asked,
Will you tell Shade and Dutiful and Nettle that Lady Amber believes B might still be alive?
I shook my head. When I truly know that I have good news for them, then I'll share it. They should not have to live in uncertainty until then.
He was nodding slowly. Abruptly he said, I'll do it. But would you write an additional message for me, if there is any message parchment on this ship?
I have a bit left from what Rain gave me. It's precious stuff. Don't you want to write it yourself?
No. I'd rather you wrote it. A note to Lord Shade, just to say that I'm doing what he asked of me, and doing it well, if you can bring yourself to say that of me. But you can say whatever you like. I won't read it before I send it. Just tell him I'm still at your side and serving you.
He looked away from me.
If you would.
I can easily do that, I said slowly. I returned to Amber's cabin and carefully penned a note in tiny letters to Shade. The fine parchment was nearly translucent. Even so, there was little space to say much more than that I was very well pleased with Fitzvigilant's service to me. I may have mentioned that, on several occasions, he had been instrumental in keeping me alive. I blew on it and waved it about to dry, and then rolled it small to make it fit in the hollow bone capsule that would protect it on its journey. On the bone itself, I lettered Shade's name and Buckkeep Castle, Buck, in the Six Duchies. It had a long, far way to travel. As I entrusted it to an abashed Lant, I wondered if any of our messages home had been received yet. I had not sealed it with wax, and he knew that was my invitation to read what I'd written. But there was no time for any discussion, for all the others were eager to get to Divitown. I decided I would leave it to Lant to compose a message explaining where we were and the peculiar nature of the live ship we were on. I had hurried, but I'd still kept the shore party waiting. Althea gave Vivacia a friendly wave before she turned and descended the ladder to the waiting rowboat. The live ship watched our party clamber down and find their places. Her smile broadened, only to fade to a puzzled stare as a small boat went directly to Divitown. As the long evening passed, Purr and I sat at the galley table, idly rolling a set of dice that belonged to the crew and moving pegs in a game board. I could not care if I won or lost, and so I played poorly, to Purr's disgust. To my wit, the ship felt empty, almost cavernous, with most of the crew gone. Clef and several of the older hands gathered at the far end of the table. Kittle had made food in the galley, and it was heartening once more to smell cooking meat. When she called us to eat, there were admiring coos from the crew. Even more enticing than the platter of sizzling meat strips was a large bowl of fresh greens. Scallions and flat pea pods, crisp stalks of a vegetable I didn't know, and mixed in with them carrots no bigger than my thumb, and piquant purple radishes. We each dished our own food onto tin plates. The strips of meat were tough and a bit gamey, but no one complained. The crew ate theirs with a white paste that was so hot it made my eyes water and my nose run when I tried it, but no one laughed at me or made a joke of it. Purr and I ate at our end of the table, apart from the crew folk. The sidelong glances we received were plain reminders that they had not forgotten who was at the root of their problems. Clef scowled at the obvious separation and came to join us, filling the empty seat at the galley table between us and the crew. After we had eaten and Ant collected the plates, Clef joined us at our game. I rolled dice and moved my pegs, but Clef and Purr knew they only competed against each other. While they gamed, I eavesdropped with one ear on the subdued talk of the crew. The older hands spoke of the old days. Some few had been there when the Paragon had been dragged off the beach, where he had languished for many a year and towed back into deep water. Others spoke of when the ship had stood up to a fleet of ordinary vessels and helped the satrap of Jamalia make his claim to power. They recalled shipmates who had died on the ship's deck and entrusted their memories to his wizard wood planks. Lop, who had not been the brightest fellow but always pulled his share of the load. Seamoy, mate for a time until there came a year when he had no strength and dwindled to bones and sinew and died while coiling a line. And they spoke of the pirate Kennet. Paragon had been his family ship, but that secret had not been known while Kennet was alive and raiding. Even fewer had known that Igrot, the notoriously cruel pirate, had stolen both ship and the boy Kennet from his family and misused both. Even after Paragon was reunited with Kennet, Kennet had tried to use fire to send him to the bottom. But in the end, when Kennet was dying, Paragon had taken him back and received him gently. It was a mystery they still discussed in soft voices. How could such a willful ship also have been so loving? Did the memories of Kennet move in him now, recalling Divitown to him? My speculation was silent. Whose memories would guide Paragon back to Clarys? Igrot's, I decided. Did the thoughts and deeds of that nefarious old pirate lurk deep in the ship's wizard wood bones? How deep did the memories of his human family and crew soak into his dragon's wood? And I wondered how Althea had felt captaining a ship that would always harbor the memories of her rapist. How much of the pirate still lurked in the ship that wanted to be two dragons? Useless questions. Purr won the game, and Clef stood up from the table. He looked weary and sad, and much older than he had when we first had come aboard. He looked around at the faces and then lifted his mug of fresh water. "Shipmates, to the end," he said, and the others nodded and drank with him. It was a strange toast that fanned my guilt to white, hot coals. "I'm taking the anchor watch," he announced, and I knew it was not his usual duty. I suspected he would spend it near the figurehead. The spy in me wondered if I could manage to witness whatever words they traded. When Purr proposed another game, I shook my head. "I need to walk a bit after that meal," I told him, and left him to tidy our game away. I leaned on the railing and watched the pirate town as the summer night descended. The sky darkened from azure to the blue that precedes black, and still Amber and the others did not return. Purr joined me on the deck to watch the lights of Divitown come out. It was a lively place, music carried to us across the water, and the angry shouts of a street fight came later. "They'll probably stay the night in the town," I told Purr, and he nodded as if he did not care or worry. We retired to Amber's cabin. "Do you miss Withywoods?" he asked me abruptly. "I don't think of it much," I told him. But I did. Not so much the house as the people and the life that had been there. Such a life for too few years. "I do," Purr said quietly. "Sometimes. I miss being so sure of what my life would be. I was going to grow taller than my father and be the tallest man, and step up to his job in the stables when he got old." "That might still be," I said, but he shook his head. For a time he was quiet. Then he told me a long, wandering tale about the first time he'd had to groom a horse much taller than he could reach. I noted that he could now speak of his father without weeping. When he fell silent, I stared out the window at the stars over the town. I dozed off for a time. When I woke, the cabin was dark, save for a smudge of light from an almost full moon. Purr was sound asleep, and I was perfectly awake. With no real idea of what had woken me, I found the boots I had kicked off, donned them, and left the cabin. On the deck, the moon and still burning lights of Divitown made the night a place of deep greys. I heard voices and walked softly towards the bow. "You're dragging anchor," Clef made his accusation factually.
The tide is running and the bottom is soft. It's scarcely my fault that the anchor isn't holding.
Paragon sounded as petulant as a boy.
I'm going to have to roust every crew member I still have aboard to hold you in place, lift anchor, and drop it again.
Perhaps not. It feels to me as if it's holding now. Perhaps it was just a bit of slippage.
I stood still, breathing softly. I looked at the town and tried to decide if the ship had moved. I couldn't decide. When I looked at Vivacia, I became certain that he had. The distance between the two live ships had closed.
Oh dear, slipping again.
The live ship's words were apologetic, but his tone was merry. We edged closer to Vivacia. She seemed unaware of us, her head drooped forward. Was she asleep? Would a ship made of wizard wood need to sleep?
Paragon!
Clef warned him.
Slipping again,
the ship announced, and our progress toward the other live ship was now unmistakable.
All hands!
Clef roared abruptly. His whistle pierced the peaceful night.
All hands on deck!
I heard shouts and the thudding of feet hitting the floor below decks, and then Paragon saying,
Vivacia, I'm dragging anchor. Catch hold of me.
Vivacia jerked to awareness, her head coming up and her eyes flashing wide. Paragon held out his arms to her in a plea, and, after a moment, she reached toward him.
Mind my bowsprit,
she cried, and narrowly they avoided that disaster. Paragon caught one of her hands and, with an impressive display of strength, pulled himself close to her. It set both ships rocking wildly, and I heard cries of alarm from Vivacia's crew. In a moment, Paragon embraced her with one arm, despite her efforts to fend him off.
Be still, he warned her, or you will tangle us hopelessly. I want to speak to you, and I want to touch you while I do so.
Fend him off!
She shouted to her crew, who came running as she pushed futilely against his carved chest. Clef was shouting commands to his crew, and someone was angrily cursing at him from Vivacia's deck, demanding to know what sort of an idiot he was. Clef tried to shout an explanation while barking orders at his crew. Paragon's laugh boomed out over the cacophony, silencing them all, except Vivacia.
Get him away from me!
Vivacia barked her command, but Paragon only shifted his grip to the curls on the back of her head and bent her backward so that her bare breasts thrust up toward him. To my astonishment, he leaned down and kissed one. As she shrieked her outrage and seized his face in her nailed hands, he increased his grip upon her hair. With his free hand, he reached up and seized a handful of the lines that festooned her bowsprit. He paid no attention to her battering.
Don't try to fend me off, he warned her crew. Get away from the foredeck, all of you. Clef, order everyone back. And you, Vivacia's crew, go back to your bunks. Unless Boyo is among you, send him to me if he's there. If not, leave us alone.
He bent his head again and tried to kiss Vivacia's face. But she seized handfuls of his hair and tried to tear it from his scalp. He let her sink her hands into it, then abruptly made it harden into carved wood under her touch.
Do you think this wood feels pain? He demanded of her. Not unless I will it to. But what do you feel when I kiss you? Do you recall Althea's outrage when Kennet forced himself upon her? Did you keep that memory, or is it solely mine, her pain absorbed by me that she might heal, as I took Kennet's pain and all Igrot did to him? Have you only human memories left to you? What do you feel, wooden ship? Or does a dragon still lurk in you? Once you named yourself Bolt, do you recall that? Do you recall the fury of a queen dragon when she rises in flight and defies all drakes to master her? What are you right now, Vivacia? a woman struggling against a man, or a queen dragon challenging her mate to master her. Abruptly, she ceased her struggling, her features set into an aristocratic look of frozen disdain. Then, heedless of his grip on her hair, she rocked her head forward and stared at him with eyes that blazed with the true light of hatred. "Mad ship!" she called him. "Pariah! What insanity is this? Will you sink yourself right here in Divitown Harbor? You are no fit mate for me, were I woman or dragon."
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a boat lowered from the Vivacia and four men rowing furiously toward Divitown, doubtless to alert someone and demand aid. If Paragon saw it go, he paid no attention to it.
"Are you certain of that?"
As he spoke the words, I felt the change ripple through the ship.
"I am certain,"
Vivacia said disdainfully. She turned her face away from him.
"What do you want of me?"
she asked in a low voice.
"I want you to recall that you are a dragon, not a ship, not a servant to the humans who sail you, not a sexless being trapped in a woman's form. A dragon, as am I."
As he spoke, he was changing, resuming his semi-dragon form. I found I had crossed my arms tightly across my chest and raised my walls. Skill and wit, I tried to contain myself as prey does when a predator threatens. I saw the dark curling hair on his skull become a dragon's scaled crest, watched as his neck grew longer and sinuous. But most astonishing of all, I watched Vivacia's face. Her expression became stone. The light that shone from her eyes grew bright and harsh as she witnessed his transformation. She did not wince from him at all. When his transformation was complete, when I felt the magic grow still, she spoke at last.
"What makes you think I have ever forgotten that I am a dragon? But what of it? Would you have me cast aside the life I have, yearning for what is lost? What life would I gain? That of a mad ship chained to a beach, isolated and avoided?"
She ran her eyes over the transformed figurehead.
"Or play at being a dragon? Pathetic."
He did not flinch at her scorn.
"You can be a dragon, as you were meant to be."
Silence. Then, in a low voice that might have held hatred or been full of pity, she said,
"You are mad." "No, I am not. Set your human memories aside. Set your time of being a ship aside. Reach back, past the long imprisonment in your case, past your time as a serpent. Can you recall being a dragon? At all?"
I thought I felt the magic moving again. Perhaps it flowed from ship to ship, from Paragon to Vivacia. I caught the edges of floating memories as if I scented foreign food. I flew with wings over the forest. The wind filled my sails, and I cut through the waves. I flew over valleys, thick with green foliage, but my eyes were keen, and I could sense every waft of warmth from living flesh, flesh that I could feed on. I moved through water, cold and deep, but beneath me I could sense shadowy pulses of being, other creatures, scaled as I once had been, free as I once had been. I found I was edging forward, drawn into that world of wings and wonder.
"Stay out of his reach,"
I thought faintly, and almost wondered if Night Eyes still lurked within me to give me that wolfish warning. But I had moved to where I could see Vivacia's face and a partial profile of Paragon. So human and so foreign were those faces.
"No," Paragon said. "Go back farther, as far as you can reach. Here, this, Remember this.
Again, I felt that surge of magic. Wit and skill seamed into a tool sharper than any sword. Once, during the Battle of Antler Island, a man had hit me on the side of my head with the hilt of his sword. It had not stopped me, and my axe had already descended between the point of his shoulder and his head as he struck. The blow did not have a great deal of force, yet it made my ears ring, and for a time the world wavered before me in odd colors. I knew it had happened, yet never had I recalled it. But as I was plunged into a dragon memory, it was as if Nettle had pulled me into a skill dream. The sensation was so similar that it woke that old memory. I felt I reeled as from a blow, and I saw a pool of sparkling silver edged with black and silver sand, and beyond its edges a meadow of black and silver grasses and white-trunked trees with black leaves beyond that. I blinked my human eyes, trying to resolve it into familiar colors. Instead, I saw a dragon, green as only gemstones are green, and as sparkling. He came from the horizon, small at first, and then looming larger and larger until he was the largest creature I'd ever seen, larger than Tintaglia or even Icefire. He landed in the silver pond, sending up plumes of silver liquid that lapped and splashed against the black sand and rocks, coating them briefly with a layer of silver. The dragon plunged his head and serpentine neck into the stuff, wallowing and washing himself in it as if he were a swan. His scales seemed to absorb it, and the green grew dazzling. Groomed with it, he then lowered his muzzle to the water and drank and drank. As he waded from the pool and composed himself for rest on the grassy bank, I had one long moment of looking into his whirling eyes. I saw age there, and wisdom, and a sort of glory I'd never seen in the eyes of a man. For a humbling instant, I knew that I looked upon a creature that was better than I would or could ever be.
"Sir? Prince Fitzchivalry?"
I started from my dream, feeling resentful. It was Purr, tugging at my sleeve, his eyes wide and dark in the dimness.
"What is it, boy?"
I wanted him to be gone. I wanted to plunge back into that world, to know that dragon, and be the better for knowing him.
"I thought you'd want to know. Our boat is coming, as fast as it can move, with Captains Althea and Brashen, and Amber and Spack and Lent, and someone from the other ship is coming too."
"Thank you, lad." I turned away from him and tried to find an entry back into that magical dream. But either it was over, or I had lost my way. I sensed the magic still streaming between the two live ships, but I could not enter to share it. Instead, I saw only the two figureheads. Despite their bowsprits, they embraced as closely as they could, as if they were lovers denied intimacy for too long. Vivacia's head rested on Paragon's scaled chest, her eyes wide, but unseeing. His longer neck had twined around her like a scarf, and his dragon's head rested on her shoulder. Her graceful hands rested on his shoulders. No enmity or uncertainty showed in her face. I could not read Paragon's dragon visage to glimpse what he was feeling, but as I watched, he changed. It was like watching the melting of river ice when water swiftly erodes it. Slowly, his features slipped back into his human configuration. His expression was tender as he embraced Althea. No, it was Vivacia he embraced so warmly. And suddenly, I saw myself holding Molly, knowing a rare moment of peace and feeling loved. And a terrible loss and longing welled in me. I was caught up in this strange tableau until I heard Brashen's voice.
"What happened?" he demanded. "How did Paragon get over here?"
"He dragged anchor, sir." Clef's reply was formal, mate to captain.
"This was no trick of the tide or a bad anchor set," Althea said. "Paragon did this for a reason."
Her tone said she doubted the reason had any good purpose. Brashen and Althea stood well clear of the figurehead's reach, watching the stillness. It was Amber who moved past them, slipping free of Spark and Lant as if she, too, were a ship
dragging anchor.
Amber, no, please!
Althea pleaded, but Amber did not pause. She stood well within Paragon's reach and waited. Vivacia lifted her head from Paragon's shoulder and breathed a great sigh.
What we were, what we might have become, it's lost to us now. The young dragons, the serpents who hatched in Treehog and live now in Kelsingra, they may become that again a century hence, but not us. Never us.
You are wrong.
Aragorn's voice was an inhuman rumble.
Amber can help us get silver. And with it, I believe we can gather enough of what we were to make ourselves what we ought to have been.
The ships moved slightly apart, breaking their embrace to look at Amber.
It is not certain, she said, and I will not make promises I may not be able to keep. The silver, yes, I promise, I will do all I can to obtain it for you. But will it be enough to transform you into dragons? I don't know.
And?
Vivacia asked abruptly.
And what?
Amber asked, startled. Vivacia's face resumed a more human cast.
And what do you ask of me in return? Traders made me what I am. Their blood and their thoughts have soaked into my deck and permeated every fiber of what I am. Nothing is free when you deal with humans. What do you want of me? Nothing.
But Amber's response vanished in Paragon's heartfelt cry.
Boyo! I want Boyo on my decks for my last voyage.
He wore my face again. Heartstruck, I wondered if I looked like that when I thought of regaining my child. Now, when he spoke, it was with a human heart.
Give me back what is truly mine. And Paragon Kennetson. I want him as well. He was promised to me so often when Kennet was a lad on my decks. He said he would have a son and name him after me. So much I endured for his family. So much pain. Without me, he would never have existed. I want him. I want him to see me and know me as the ship of his family, before I become dragons and leave him forever.
Forever.
I heard that forlorn whisper from Althea and knew that until now she had dared to hope that Paragon might change his mind or at least keep some link to her and Brashen after he transformed.
Paragon!
A shout from Vivacia's deck, a welcoming cry in a man's deep voice. I saw a young man in his mid-twenties with a dense mop of curly dark hair and a ready grin. He was tanned to mahogany and his shirt strained at his wide shoulders. Anyone who had seen Brashen and Althea would know he was their son. He held a lantern aloft and clearly he had not an inkling of what was going on. He regarded his homeship with joy.
Trelvestrit!
Someone shouted behind him. But Boyo had already set down the lantern and scrambled up to Vivacia's bowsprit. He ran lightly along it, and then, without hesitation, threw himself toward Paragon. Paragon released Vivacia immediately. He caught and lofted the young man as I had once lifted dutiful small sons. And, as I had then, he feigned tossing him into the air before catching him securely once more. Agile as a tumbler, the man accepted this treatment and laughed aloud at being caught. Freeing himself of the ship's grip, he climbed onto Paragon's hands and then launched himself backward, flipping in the air and landing again nimbly on the ship's outstretched hands. Plainly, it was a game from his childhood, one they both recalled with pleasure. Seldom had I seen that level of trust between any two creatures. Paragon could have torn Boyo in half with his big wooden hands, but instead, he held him at arm's length, and the two studied each other, the man grinning as he looked up at the ship's face. Unnoticed by me, and perhaps also by Paragon, lines had been thrown to men in small rowing boats, and they were hauling Paragon in one direction, and Vivacia in the other, swinging both on their anchor chains as they separated the two ships to a safe distance. I wondered if Boyo had been aware of the plan, and then I wondered if Paragon cared. He had made his plea to Vivacia and had half of what he had requested, and the look on Boyo's face was one of fearless love for his ship. No wonder Paragon had missed him. Prince Fitz, hush, I bade Purr. I was watching Althea and Brashen. Their conflict showed plainly on their faces. Love for their son, worry for him in the ship's hands, but also that fondness of watching the two together. Boyo said something to Paragon as the ship caught him, and the figurehead threw back his head and roared with laughter. Looking at them, I could scarcely believe this was the same being that had been so supremely unconcerned for his crew's welfare. I half expected Brashen or Althea to call to their son with a warning, but they were both silent and waiting. Confident in the young man or in their ship, I wondered. As Paragon twisted to put him on the deck, I heard Boyo say to the ship, I have missed you so. Vivacia is a very fine ship, but she is always serious, and Cousin Wintrow is an excellent captain, but he sets a very simple table. Mother, Papa, there you are! What brings you to Divytown without a bird to warn us of your coming? I was at the sailmaker's when they came running to fetch me. If we'd known to expect you, you would have had a much better welcome. Any sight of you is welcome enough for us, his father exclaimed heartily as Boyo stepped down from Paragon's hands. The figurehead was smiling so broadly over his shoulder at all three of them that I could scarcely reconcile what I was seeing. Amber, forgotten by all, had retreated. I reached out and touched her sleeve, saying quietly, It's Fitz. And she came to me with a shuddering sigh of relief, hugging my arm as if I were flotsam on a stormy sea. She was breathless.
Are they all safe? Was anyone hurt?
All safe. Boyo is with his parents, and Clef, and some of the crew.
I was terrified.
I watched her try to calm herself and spoke soothingly. Yet Paragon seems calm now, affable.
He is two, Fitz, two dragons. I think it was what drove him mad, and sometimes I feel like he has two natures. One is boyish, a prankster who desperately craves affection and companionship. The other is capable of almost anything.
I think I have seen both tonight.
Then we are all fortunate that Boyo brought out his kindlier nature. Angered, there is no telling what one live ship could do to another.
Do they fight? Can a live ship be killed?
A live ship can be destroyed with fire, or disfigured, as Paragon was.
She tilted her head and considered.
I've never heard of a physical altercation between live ships, jealousies and rivalries, quarrels, but not taken to a physical level.
I became aware that Purr was standing nearby, listening. In the shadows behind him, Spark waited beside Lant. Shall we return to our cabin? I suggested. I'm anxious to hear what transpired on shore.
Please,
Amber replied, and as we began to walk that way, she leaned more heavily on my arm. Yet before we could reach our cabin, Clef sought us out.
Captains want to see all of you in their stateroom, please.
He added the courtesy, but it wasn't a request. Thank you. We will go directly there. Clef gave a nod and disappeared silently into the darkness. Night had fallen over the harbor. Lanterns burned on the masts of nearby ships, and lamplight shone in the more distant windows of Divytown. But they were only brighter sparks beneath the far-flung strewing of stars above us in the night sky. I looked up and suddenly longed fiercely for good forest and soil under my feet and pray that I could kill and eat. For the simple things that made life good.
Chapter 17. Serpent Spit.
My king and queen, and esteemed Lady Ketrican, I have reached my destination and have had several meetings with King Rain and Queen Malta of the Dragon Traders. Trader Cupras, mother to King Rain, was also in attendance representing the Rain Wild Traders. This was an unexpected inclusion for me to deal with. The two skill healers who accompanied me could effect some small healing tasks for the people here. I cautioned them against greater works, but both said that the influence of the skill runs strongly here and might sweep their minds away. And there is also the consideration that large works should merit large favors in return, and I fear I do not foresee that happening. Both the king and queen assert that they have small influence with the dragons and cannot order them to stop their raids on our herds and flocks. In truth, their rulers appear to have little authority over their people as well, with all large decisions being made by a consensus. I am not certain how to deal with such a situation, nor can Trader Cupras speak for any beyond her own family, saying that any contracts we wish to make, that is, healing for trade goods, must be voted on by the Traders' Council. I recall that you advised me to be as generous as we can be during this first meeting, but in my opinion, if we give too freely of what these people so greatly desire, we will lose much of our bargaining ability. The skill users you sent with me suggest that perhaps it were better to establish a healing centre in the Six Duchies and advise the Rainwild folk to seek our services there, where the skill current is more manageable. Here, the skill influence waxes so strong that I must send this message to you by bird. We shall take ship to return home in 3 days. In your service, Lady Rosemary. We did not dare stay long in Suelsby. Dwalia could not be sure how many people might recognize us from that bloody night. Over and over, she asked Vindelire how much Kerf would recall and how much he would tell.
"He won't forget,"
Vindelire had whined.
"I did not have time to tell him to forget. You made us run away. He will be confused, but he won't forget what he did. He will tell if they hurt him enough."
He had shaken his blunt head sadly.
"They always talk when you hurt them that much. You showed me that."
"And you whimpered and pissed yourself like a kicked cur,"
she had replied vindictively. And so, instead of having Vindelire Magicus into an inn and a room, we slept that night under a bridge to stay away from spying eyes. As soon as the sun lightened the sky, she made us wade out into the chilly river and try to rinse some of the blood from our clothes. We weren't alone for long. Men and women from the town came bearing baskets of linens and clothing. The washerfolk each had their own areas along the rocky shore, and they set up their drying racks and glared us away from the riverbank. Dwalia led us back toward the town. I think towns and busy streets were all she knew. I would have sought the forest for a time, to let folk forget us. Instead, she had hissed at Vindelire,
"Make us unremarkable. Restore my face. Leave no injury for them to notice. Do it."
I know he tried. I felt the lapping of his magic against my senses. I do not think he did it very well. But in a port city, poor folk are not uncommon, and we did not look so strange that we drew many glances. We stayed well away from the lovely inn and the well-travelled street where Trader Acriel had died. Dwalia took us to the seedy section of the harbour, where the signboards of the inns were weathered grey and splintery, and the gutters ran greenish and stinking beside the streets. Dwalia and I hunkered out of sight in an alley or sat at the edge of the street, hands out to beg in vain. Vindelire moved slowly up and down the street, seeking easy prey. Some folk were easier to influence than others. He took a little from each, a few coins here, a few coins there. They gave willingly, or so they would recall it, even if they could not remember why. Toward evening, he had collected enough that we could have a hot meal and sleep inside one of the cheap inns. It was nothing like the inn Trader Acriel had taken me to. The sleeping area was simply a loft over the room below. We found unoccupied space and lay down in our clothes. I could not help
but contrast that night with the future I had nearly gained. When I was sure the others slept, I allowed myself to weep. I tried to think of Withywoods, my home and my father, but those things seemed distant and more unlikely than my dreams. For dreams came to me that night, pelting me like hailstones. After each, I jolted awake, seized with the need to tell someone, to write them down, to sing of them. It was a compulsion as strong as when one must vomit, but I choked them back. Dwalia would rejoice in them, and I would not give her that. And so my dream of the slow team of oxen that trampled a child into a muddy street, my dream of a wise queen who planted silver and reaped golden wheat, my dream of a man who rode a huge red horse across ice to a new land, all those I choked back and swallowed. If they spoke of futures, she would not know of them. It made me feel ill and wretched to keep those dreams inside me. But the satisfaction I took in any small way I could thwart Dwalia outweighed the sickness. The next day, I was so shaky I could scarcely walk. Vindelia looked concerned for me, while Dwalia wore a calculating look.
"We need to leave this city and move on," she told him. "Look into their minds. See if anyone is going to Clarys, or has been there."
He had persuaded a breadmonger to part with a loaf. Dwalia had portioned it out, half for herself and the rest for Vindelia. He had looked at it hungrily, and then reluctantly given me half of his half. It was no bigger than my fist, but it was all I could do to nibble it down. I heard Vindelia speak quietly to Dwalia.
"I think she's sick."
Dwalia looked at me and smiled.
"She is, and I'm glad. It means I'm at least partially right."
Her words made no sense to me. As the day passed, my misery increased. I huddled as far away from her as my chain would let me and tried to sleep. Vindelia took his small tolls from passing folk. Dwalia sat like a toad and watched the town go by. I decided to test her idea that no one would help me. I cried out for help. A few folk turned heads, but she jerked on my chain.
"New to slavery," Dwalia explained blithely,
and my babble of hasty words that she was lying, I was no slave but kidnapped, went unheeded. I was just another foreign slave. One man stopped and spoke to her in common, asking if I was for sale. His eyes were not kind. Dwalia replied that he could pay her for a few hours with me, but that he could not buy me. He looked at me speculatively. Terror inspired me, and I began to retch, forcing a thin bile to spill from my mouth and down onto my clothing. The man shook his head, plainly not wanting to share whatever disease I had, and hurried on. Whatever ailed me took a firm grip on me the next day. In the pleasant warmth of the summer day, I curled up and shivered with cold. The bright sunlight could not warm me. It only battered me in pink darkness through my closed eyelids as the fever racked me. On the splintery floor of the inn loft, I shivered, and Vindelia rolled over and put his arm over me. He smelled offensive to me. It was not the grime or sweat of him. It was his own scent that repelled me. Wolf sense told me to beware of him. I tried to shake off his arm, but I was too weak.
"Brother, let me keep you warm," he whispered. "It wasn't your fault."
"My fault?" I heard myself mutter. Of course it wasn't. None of this was my fault.
"I did it. I created the rift that allowed you to run away. Dwalia told me. When I did not do as I knew she would have wished me to, it opened another path for you, and you followed it, taking us farther and farther from the path. So now we must endure hardship and pain as we make our thorny way back to the path. Once we are on our way to Clarys again, our difficulties will ease."
I tried to shrug his arm away, but he drew me closer. His stink was all around me, gagging me with every breath I took.
"You should learn this lesson, brother. Once you accept the path, all in life is easier. Dwalia guides us. I know she seems cruel, but she is only angry and harsh because you have taken us so far from the true path. Help us go back to it, and it will be so much easier for all of us."
The words did not sound like him or Dwalia. Perhaps he parroted some long-ago lesson. I summoned every shred of will I had. I forced out my words. "My true path goes home." He patted my shoulder.
"There. You are right. Your true path will take you to your true home. Now that you admit that, things will become easier."
I hated him. I curled on the floor, sick and angry and powerless. Dwalia moved us to a different part of the waterfront and hailed passers-by to ask if any had news of a ship bound for Clarys. Most shrugged, and the rest ignored her. I huddled miserably while Vindelire kept a distance from us as he moved up and down the streets and
begged.
He chose those he accosted, and I knew they had little choice as he pushed his thoughts against theirs. I saw their reluctance as they reached into purses or pockets, and witnessed their confusion as they wandered away from him. The area was not rife with wealthy folk. I suspected that Vindelire showed mercy in the small amounts he charmed from each victim. Yet Dwalia always berated him for not coercing more money out of his victims. One day, he did not get enough money for us to sleep inside. I had thought I could not feel worse, but as the chill of evening came on, I shook until my teeth chattered. Dwalia commonly took small notice of my misery, but I think that evening she worried that I might die. She did nothing to give me comfort, but only turned her anger on Vindelire.
"What's wrong with you?"
she demanded of him when the streets had emptied and there was no one in earshot to hear her scold him.
"You used to be strong. Now you are useless. You used to control a cavalcade of mercenaries, hiding them from sight. Now you can barely charm a penny or two from a farmer's purse."
For the first time in many a day, I heard a note of spirit in his voice.
"I am hungry and tired, am far from home, and unhappy with all I have seen. I try very hard. I need..."
"No,"
she interrupted him furiously.
"You do not need. You want. And I know what you want. Do you think I don't know how much pleasure you take from it? I've seen your eyes roll back with it and how you drool. No, there is only one left, and we must save it against most dire need. Then there will be no more for you, Vindelire. No more ever, for it has become scarce since the nine-fingered slave boy set the serpent free."
How strangely those words rang in me, like a memory of something I'd never experienced. A nine-fingered slave boy. I could almost see him, dark-haired and slight, strong only in his will to do what was right. The serpent was in a stone pool. I breathed the words to myself. It had not been a dream of a snake in a bowl. No.
"What did you say?"
Dwalia demanded sharply. "I am sick," I said, a repetition of words I'd said so often over the last few days. I closed my eyes and turned my face away. But with my eyes closed, I could not control the images that filled my mind. The slave boy came to the stone pool. He wrestled with the iron bars that ringed it. Eventually, he made a path for the deformed serpent that crawled out of the pool and into water. Yes, into water, an incoming tide. How could I recall something I'd never seen? And yet the waves lapped up and into the pool, replenishing but not cleansing it. Both slave and serpent dissolved into whiteness. I saw no more. I opened my eyes to breaking dawn. We had slept on the streets, yet I no longer felt chilled. I ached, as one does after sleeping on hard earth, or after a long sickness has kept one still. I sat up slowly, or tried to. Dwalia had rolled over onto the chain. I took it in both hands and jerked it out from under her. She opened her eyes to glare at me. I snarled back at her. She made a noise, a snort from her nose, as if to say she did not fear me. I resolved then that the next time she slept, I would give her a reason to fear me again. My gaze travelled lovingly over the rancid bite I'd given her. Then I lowered my eyes, lest she guess my plan. She got to her feet and kicked Vindalaya.
Up, she said. Time to move on, before someone wonders why they gave half their coins to a beggar yesterday.
I squatted and pissed in a gutter, wondering when I had lost all modesty and indeed all civilized ways. My mother would not have known me, with my knotted hair and dust-stained skin and filthy nails. The tidy garments that Trader Ackrill had given me could not withstand the sort of use I was giving them now. Tears welled in my eyes when I thought of her. I rubbed them away, doubtless smearing dirt down my face with them. Then I looked at my hands. Peelings of skin clung to my fingers. I shook them clean and looked up to find Dwalia sneering with satisfaction.
The path knows her, even if she does not know the path, she said to Vindalaya, who looked awestruck.
Then she gave my chain a sharp tug, and I was forced to go stumbling after her. My arms itched, and when I scratched them, my skin came away in thin layers that wadded like cobwebs at my touch. It was not a sunburn peeling. The layer that came off me was fine as gossamer, and beneath it my skin was not pink, but paler, chalky. At the waterfront, we dodged barrows and donkey carts and folk carrying bales on their shoulders. Dwalia guided us to a stretch of market stalls. At the smell of food, my stomach leapt up inside my throat and choked me. I had not felt hunger for days, but now it assailed me mercilessly till I felt dizzy and shaky. Dwalia slowed, and I hoped she was as hungry as I was and had some coins for food. But instead, she tugged me along to stand in a growing crowd clustered around a tall man with broad shoulders standing on a cart. He wore a high hat striped in many colors. His cloak had a collar that stood up to his ears, and it, too, was striped. I had never seen such garments. Behind the man in the cart was a wooden cabinet with row after row of little drawers, each drawer of a different color, and each carved with an emblem. Over the man's head, scarves and tiny bells hung from a framework of sticks. The wind off the water was a near constant, and so the bells tinkled and the scarves fluttered. Even the big grey horse that waited patiently in his traces had ribbons and bells in his mane. Never had I seen such a spectacle. For that moment, my hunger was forgotten. What wondrous things could such a merchant be selling? That seemed to be the question everyone was pondering. He spoke in a language I did not know, and then abruptly he shifted into common.
A fortune for you to guide your footsteps into a lucky path, brought to you from a far-off place. Do you wince at a silver for such knowledge? Foolish you! Where else in this market can you part with a silver and receive wisdom and luck? Should you wed? Will your wife grow heavy with child? Should you plant for the roots or the leaves this year? Come, come, you need not wonder. Press a silver to your brow, and then pass it to me with your question. The coin will tell me which box to open. Come, come, who will try? Who will be first?
Dwalia made a sound in her throat like a cat's growl. I glanced back at Vindalaya. His eyes were very wide. He saw my stare and spoke in a whisper.
He imitates the small prophets of Clarys, the one sent out by the Four. It is forbidden to do what he is doing. He is a fraud.
Two people turned to stare at him. Vindalaya lowered his eyes and fell silent. The man on the cart was chattering on, in both languages, and suddenly a woman was waving a coin at him. When he nodded to her, she pressed the coin firmly to her forehead and then offered it to him. He smiled, took her silver, and pressed it to his brow. He asked her a question, and she replied. Then to the larger crowd in common, he announced,
"She wishes to know if her mother and her sister will welcome her if she makes the long journey to visit them."
He pressed the coin once more to his brow and held it out. His hand wavered and circled. It looked indeed as if the coin led his hand to the little door he selected. He opened it, and from it he extracted a nut. That startled me. It was gold, or painted with gilt. He struck it suddenly against his brow, as if he were cracking an egg. Then he offered it to the woman. Hesitantly, she took it and opened the nut. It had split as evenly as if sliced by a knife. Delighted, she opened it on her palm and drew out a thin strip of paper. It was white, but edged in yellow, blue, red, and green along its sides. She stared at it and then offered it back to him, asking him something.
"Read it! Read it!"
The crowd echoed her request. He took it back from her. He had elegant hands, and he made quite a show of drawing the narrow coil of paper out and perusing the lines lettered there. His pause, as his eyes moved over it, prompted the crowd to edge closer.
"Ah, good news for you, good news indeed. You asked for advice on a journey, and here it is for you. Walk with the sunshine and enjoy the road. A well-laid table and a clean bed await you at your destination. Your arrival fills a house with joy. There, pack your bag and be on your way. And now, who is next? Who will hear what fortune awaits you? Isn't it worth a coin to know?"
A young man waved a coin. The merchant took it, and again he put on a performance worthy of any puppeteer before he presented the fortune from the golden nut to the man. He received good tidings for the marriage offer he wished to present, and stepped back from the cart, grinning. More coins were being waved now, some frantically. Dwalia watched, eyes narrowed, like a cat at a mouse hole, as the merchant accepted money and foretold fortunes. Not all were good. A man who asked about crops was instead warned that he should save his money and not make a purchase he had been considering. He looked dumbstruck, and then told the crowd,
"I came to market today to look for a plough horse, but now I will wait."
A couple hoping for a pregnancy, a man thinking of selling his land, a woman who wanted to know if her father would recover from an injury, so many folk seeking to know what tomorrow would bring. Once or twice the merchant would take the coin, hold it to his brow, and then wave it about and frown.
"It's not leading me," he'd say. "I'll need a larger piece of silver from you to find the answer to your question."
And to my astonishment, folk would give him a bigger coin. It was as if once they had started on the path, they could not turn aside. Some read their coiled message aloud, others curled over the string of paper and read it privately. The fortune merchant read them aloud for folk who were unlettered. Door after door of his little cabinet he opened. His audience did not grow smaller. Even those who had bought a fortune lingered to find out what others might hear. Dwalia moved us to the edge of the crowd, but there she stopped and whispered to Vindelire,
"Control him."
"Him?"
Vindelire did not whisper. I saw that she longed to cuff him, but she restrained herself. Obviously, she did not wish to distract those watching the merchant.
"Yes, him, the one selling fake fortunes."
She spoke through gritted teeth.
"Oh."
Vindelire studied the man. I could sense tendrils of his magic floating and feeling their way toward him, and I knew he couldn't do it. The man was too strong of self to be captured by such feeble threads. I could sense the shape the fortune merchant made in the world, and to my surprise, I could feel that he had a sort of magic shimmer to him. He did not reach out with his magic as Vindelire did. Instead, his magic coated him just as his bright colours did, and like his colours, it invited folk to study him and draw near. I reached toward his magic and pushed on it gently. For a moment, he looked puzzled. I moved away. All he could do was draw people in. He probably didn't even know he was using it. I looked back at Vindelire and found him regarding me strangely. I looked away and scratched my neck under the collar. I hadn't intended to touch his magic. I'd done it without thinking, and somehow Vindelire had sensed it, and now his suspicions were stirred. The fortune merchant was waving a coin, letting it guide his hand to a little door with a bird on it. I pretended vast interest in his show.
"I can't do it,"
Vindelire said to Dwalia. His face crumpled before she even glared at him.
"There is no way into him."
"Make a way."
I can't.
He drew the word out, long and slow. She seethed silently for a moment, then seized the shoulder of his shirt and pulled him.